Joining me now is Jason Davis with Lane County Public Health. He is the information officer with the county there. And Jason, you know, I think a lot of us thought that, you know, we were going to be done with this by this time. Kind of run us through, you know, what happened after June 30th when we kind of released those regulations.
Yeah, sure. And I think, you know, it's important to talk about what happened before June 30th as well. So, you know, going into June 30th, when the state decided to de-escalate all the restrictions, regulations, and various mandates that affected our daily lives, we had only known the primary COVID strain and a few variants that proved to be pretty innocuous when it comes to their effect on the overall escalation of cases. And so, you know, when you're looking at public policy, when you're looking at making decisions for large groups of people when it comes to their health and safety, you really do have to go based on the evidence. And while we knew that variants would continue to pop up, we had no idea that they would pop up as quickly and move as rapidly as they did. There towards the end of June, we were tracking with the situation in India. And about that time, it became known that this was a separate and unique new variant that they were experiencing over there. So, you know, I remember talking to our health officer, Dr. Ludke, and he said, there is no reason to believe that it won't come here. It's just a matter of when. And you know, we're sunsetting all these restrictions. People were happy. They wanted to go about their daily lives. And the last thing we want to do is say, hey, you know, these are all going away. And to some extent, you can regain normalcy. But watch out. There's a new variant and it might come here. But that's what we were saying behind closed doors. And you do want to balance, you know, that sort of Chicken Little, the sky's falling conversation all the time. You know, you do want to give people hope because that's the energy that carries us through the next endeavor. Unfortunately, that variant, the Delta variant, just made its way to Lane County much faster than we had hoped or anticipated. And we started to see the first cases, I think, really, really soon, probably right around the July 4th is when the first cases made their way into Lane County. We started picking them up about a week later with the genomic sequencing. And then we believe by the end of July, they represented roughly 80% of the overall cases. And you've seen the national news about what is unique about the Delta variant. It does seem to bind to our pulmonary cells or our lung cells a little bit better. It also reproduces at a faster rate. We also think that the virus itself is somewhat smaller, which allows it to inhabit smaller water droplets. And by virtue of that and a few other things, it is more transmissible. You know, we've heard reports from 10 times more transmissible up to 1,000 times more transmissible. And I don't think we have a really solid R rate or reproductive rate yet, but it's pretty clear that the transmission has now sort of superseded those tried and true interactions that we had come to know, like small gatherings and things like that. We're seeing a lot more transmission just throughout our communities, in Florence included. So not just our small gatherings, not just our workplace outbreaks, not just our long-term care facilities, but we're seeing a lot of community transmission. Seeing more and more people who are unable to pinpoint having any kind of exposure with anybody that was positive.
Is there a sense, I mean, was anybody saying that had it not been for the Delta variant, we might have been done with this by now?
I think that there was a sense of that, yes. I think that, you know, the vaccine really did prove to be a very effective means of reducing the viral particles in your nose and throat, which then in turn means that the average vaccinated person is probably not going to spread it on to anybody else. So if you look at 70 to 80% of your population being vaccinated, and that was our goal, then you can put an end date on the pandemic and you can say, once we achieve that, then the risk of any kind of big outbreak is very, 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 very small. And we can confidently say that in most large groups, the majority of people are going to be vaccinated. And so that was really where we were placing a lot of our hope. Now the situation has changed, but it hasn't changed so much. The vaccine is still not our way out of the pandemic. And to quote Dr. Ludke just this last week, he said, look, masking, distancing, washing your hands, staying home when you're sick, that's our way to get through this pandemic and basically to survive this pandemic. But vaccination is the way out of this pandemic. Because it does, even though you can transmit COVID after you've been vaccinated, that's why we're asking people to mask up, even if they're vaccinated, it's at a much lower level. We're not seeing near the transmission between vaccinated people to unvaccinated people or vaccinated people to vaccinated people that we are with an unvaccinated person transmitting the illness. So it still is an effective means. It's just maybe slightly less so. According to the recent data, when Pfizer was received full FDA approval, they came out with the stat of 88% effective at reducing severe illness, up to 91%. So between 88 and 91%. And then we're thinking anywhere between 60 and 70% effective at reducing transmission. So, a very, very effective vaccine, and still one of our best ways to get out of this pandemic, but not quite the silver bullet that we had anticipated back in January when we began our vaccination effort.
What kind of numbers are we seeing? I mean, I know I'm watching the daily totals for Florence. Yeah. What kind of trajectory is Florence taking right now, say versus infections versus vaccinations? I know we've had a couple of clinics here over the past 3 to 4 weeks that have had a little bit of success, but I think they're only in the 60s, less than three digits. Yeah. So how are we looking as far as the vaccinations and as far as the infections are going to date?
Well, your vaccines are increasing. And, 67 is not the kind of numbers that we got back last spring and last winter, when we were vaccinating 1,000 people out there at the Florence Event Center. But, as you mentioned, this last clinic was around 67 individuals. And then out in Mapleton, they got 15 individuals. But proportionally, with the percentage of the population that has yet to be vaccinated, that makes a significant difference. We've seen around a 1.5% increase to 2% increase in the vaccination since the beginning of July in Florence, which, albeit small percentages, it does make a difference. However, the rate of disease has climbed at a much more rapid rate. We saw, triple digit cases out there in Florence, in a 7-day period for a while, and then it's maintained that trajectory. Now, the good news is, in a 9,000 person town, a 14,000 person zip code, is that you can expect the self-termination of the virus to be much quicker than it would be, let's say, in the larger metropolitan area of Eugene Springfield. And what I mean by that is you will reach a critical mass of people being infected at a sooner date. It'll take less time to reach that. Now, proportionally, will you see fewer hospitalizations? No, that's not what that means. And proportionally, will you see fewer deaths? No. It just means that you have fewer people, and by virtue of that, you'll see those cases burn out a little bit quicker.
How does that play when you look at the tourist aspect of that? I guess once people get the virus, they will have antibodies, so there may be a lesser chance of that doing that. So are you saying once the community gets hit pretty steadily, incoming people from outside will have more of a chance of getting it than giving it?
That's correct. Yeah. You will reach a point at which, you have your vaccinated population who has a certain amount of antibody production as a result of that vaccine. And then you'll have your natural immunity population and hopefully some crossover of people who are vaccinated, but still contracted and have, both types of immunity to some extent. The natural immunity we know lasts anywhere from 3 to 6 months. It is not as effective as the immunity you received from the vaccination. However, it does prevent reinfection to a certain degree. So I think, the short-term prognosis for Florence is that probably by the end of September, you will begin to see your cases really dropping off, if not sooner. And then you will have a relatively decent chance of preventing outbreaks for the next few months by virtue of that durability of your immunity, both kinds of immunity. Now, if you didn't have anybody vaccinated, it'd be a much different situation. But you have a good amount of people vaccinated and you are getting quite a few people sick. And so that perfect storm there will mean that your October, November, December will likely look pretty good. Now the caveat to all that is, that's what we were saying at the beginning of June too. And look what happened. So I think the big outlier here is understanding, yes, there are public health interventions that we can turn to for help, like vaccination, like, all the different tactics that we've been pushing and, a rise in therapeutic treatments for our more severe cases. However, the big thing that's going to protect us from future pandemics, the number one best prevention strategy, is understanding that these infectious illnesses are not a joke and they can take a huge toll on our communities. And I know that a lot of folks who are in the camp that kind of is very critical of the governmental response, critical of the shutdowns and the mandates. My message to you would be that if we do nothing, there will be a tremendous impact. We're seeing businesses shut down right now purely by virtue of the fact that they have too many people sick. So there is an impact financially to the community just by virtue of the disease itself, having nothing to do with any kind of governmental intervention or mandates or shutdowns. And so I think that what we need to do as a community, as a society, as a nation, as a world, is understand the gravity of these infectious illnesses and make sure that we are adjusting our individual lives, habits, and goings on through the day to be pro-health, to recognize that transmitting an illness is not a good thing. And we have steps that we can take to mitigate it.
Absolutely. Now, I recently heard, and you might not have the statistics there because I know you have to kind of gather stuff, but I just heard today about a church gathering that had quite a few infections here in the Florence area. Are we still seeing gatherings like that bring this out? Because I know there's certain groups of people that don't get vaccinated for one reason or another.
Yeah, to my point earlier, small gatherings are still absolutely a factor in driving the cases because that gathering is not necessarily a pro-health behavior. And when we say small gatherings, we're classifying that as anything under 50 people.
Right.
When we're doing our outbreak investigations. So, you know, when you walk into someone's house and there's 40 people there, you might not think of that as a small gathering. Neither would I. I think that's a party. And, you know, in those close quarters, there's plenty of opportunity for transmission. But what's probably more troublesome is that we are seeing cases arise from outdoor barbecues, outdoor picnics, family gatherings, family reunions. There was a baby shower in Eugene that had 12 people at the baby shower. Everyone at the baby shower was asymptomatic, you know, or didn't show any symptoms of COVID. They thought they were fine. They were outdoors. One person was sick, and 11 out of the 12 ended up becoming sick from that one person. So basically everybody who attended that baby shower within a week had COVID. And that was outdoors. So that's something that's unique about Delta is we're seeing outdoor transmission. And that's one of the reasons why you saw that mandate come from state here this last week, or today, really. It was the first day of it. And what that does is it ups the likelihood of transmission happening in encounters like at a grocery store. It ups the transmission, the possibility of transmission at a place like a bar or a restaurant. You name it, it ups the transmission possibility. So while we're still tracking those small gatherings, we're noticing more and more transmission just happen out and about. And I think that was one of our concerns early on. And quite frankly, George, most of what we were concerned about back in March of 2020, when we really started looking at worst case scenarios, a lot of it didn't come to fruition in Lane County. We didn't see large community transmission. We didn't see the kind of scenarios where our hospitals were being overrun. Now that's happening. Now everything that we talked about in March is finally happening. And from a messaging standpoint and a public trust standpoint, in some ways, and this sounds horrible, but it's almost unfortunate because what we warned about, you know, took a year and a half to get here. And so everyone has let their guard down collectively, and we've gone about our daily lives. And that action combined with the Delta variant is really getting us into a worst case scenario.
Yeah, we're paying the price for that now. Let me ask you a question. I was on a Zoom meeting the other day that had to do with the football team here having to cancel their first game because of a couple of potential COVID cases. One of the men on the Zoom meeting was saying that, well, he doesn't understand, you know, why the state is so much stricter than either the federal or the CDC guidelines are permitting. Is there an understanding about that? Is that an accurate statement, or are we being a little bit more cautious here? And if so, what's the reasoning?
Well, you know, and I think, you know, one of the things you'd have to base any kind of comments on is an understanding of civics. You need to know that when it comes to most of this, we have a very loosely consolidated public health system. So the CDC's guidance is usually a recommendation, almost always. If you look at the precedent going all the way back to 2008, you'll see that sort of very, very loose consolidation between the CDC and state health departments and then local health departments. And the funding is even very loosely connected. So you don't see a lot of that top-down action where you have very strict federal guidance and then that will in turn influence state guidance. You see a much more patchwork system. And what that leads to is individual states sort of understanding what's going on there and taking the actions that they feel appropriate based on, hopefully, public health guidance. I don't think that's true in every state in the union. But in Oregon, that is what happens. And, you know, you can think what you will about our governor and her decisions, but I can tell you one thing that is true, and that is she listens to the Oregon Health Authority and the expertise that they provide her. And most of the decisions are really based on, you know, their kind of modeling of where we are going to be if we just keep on going without any kind of intervention. This last time around, I think she really sought for local public health departments to and local counties to really step up and have more of a say in the guidance and more of a say in the restrictions. And you saw that play out in a few places. The big problem with that, you know, when you're trying to understand why things happen the way they do, in Oregon, we have to have an ordinance attached to any kind of mandate in order for it to be enforceable by law. Typically, your process of passing an ordinance always has to go through a vote by your commissioners, but it usually takes about a month to a month and a half to go through all the different legal reviews and then to put that in front of a vote. So if you're needing immediate action, we as a state really did not set our local public health or our counties up for success to be able to achieve that. So counties were really faced with this idea of putting out a mandate that had no enforcement capacity. And at that point, you're just kind of doing what has unfortunately become par for the course when it comes to COVID, which is, your mandates are really recommendations when you really boil it down to it. The one piece of that is unique and is beneficial for the state to take action is that you can use OSHA through their enforcement capacity to impose fines. But you know, when Lane County was looking at this, we said it just does not make sense for us to impose a mandate that we can't back up with any kind of enforcement. We need to rely on the 18 months of education that our community, our county has had about how to prevent COVID and what happens when we don't prevent COVID, and then lean on their understanding and their goodwill and their community mindedness to try to spread that. And we've seen to a degree some good success there with about 55% of our county really adhering to the guidance and doing what's healthy. And unfortunately, you know, you have some fence sitters in there and then about 43% of our community kind of is bucking the trend. And again, the unfortunate side of it is not necessarily really based on any kind of evidence, based on any kind of health rationale. It's mostly based on philosophical opposition, political opposition, and a fear that these COVID restrictions are the, you know, first domino in a chain reaction of a tyrannical takeover or something to that nature. And I can tell you right now that Lane County Public Health, we really do have quite a bit of autonomy when it comes to how we manage infectious illnesses in our community. And we are operating off the guidance of Dr. Ludke and Dr. Guzman, off the guidance of our hospital systems who are telling us what's going on, boots on the ground, off the guidance of our local providers who are telling us what their patients are saying when they come in sick with COVID to their primary care provider. We're not operating off of governor's orders. We're not operating off of a CDC mandate. We're operating off of what our people who have been doing this for 30, 40 years all over the world, Dr. Ludke has served on 6 continents, are telling us the way out of this and what's best and what's going to preserve life in Lane County.
So we all know about the situations in the hospitals now. We know how dire things are. We know that it might even get a little bit more difficult if some healthcare providers choose not to get vaccinated and maybe go away and the staffing gets even more critical. What do we think is going to happen over the next, you know, 3 to 4 weeks?
Well, another unfortunate side effect from these very drastic case increases is that, you know, when you think about how COVID works, right, you have your exposure and then you don't become symptomatic if you're going to be symptomatic for 3 to 4 days. And then you're infectious about 10 days after that symptomatic onset. And then understanding that between 25 and 30% of our population will be asymptomatic and could potentially pass that on to other folks, and couple that with when we see these kind of numbers, it really inhibits public health's ability to respond. So we're only doing case interviews for people under the age of 18 and over the age of 59. You start to see a situation where the deaths will increase and the hospitalizations will increase long after the case numbers decrease. And so that's what we're worried about happening. And that's what we kind of think probably will happen. Is that we will see our case numbers start to decrease and we will all collectively breathe a sigh of relief. However, our hospitalizations will not decrease. They may even go up. And unfortunately, when our hospitalizations increase, so do our deaths. Just today, we had 4 deaths. If you looked at our hospital numbers, they went down by 4. So you can see what happened there.
Right. You can do the math. What about some of the new IV therapy and the new shot therapy? I know Peace Health rolled out the IV therapy on that. What do we know as far as from a health factor is that?
Well, we're partnering with them and we're trying to encourage it as much as possible, because what happens with that is, let's say you have diabetes, let's say you're overweight and you have COVID. Well, the chances that you're going to have a positive outcome from COVID are not very good. So we want to get you in and get you some treatment. And what that's going to do is that's going to prevent you from taking up a hospital bed. It'll also prevent you from dying and from developing serious illness, which on an individual level is a very good thing. But and from a community standpoint, it's a positive thing because we're not sending you to the hospital and taking up a bed that maybe a cardiac patient might need, you know, and someone who can't just prevent the illness that they've been that they've received. So it's really a positive thing. It's not a cheap thing. And that's the crux of all this. And it also should never be viewed as a way out of your infection. It should be viewed only, and you will need a doctor's prescription, by the way, to receive these treatments. You can't just get COVID and say, you know what, I really don't want to experience being flat on my back for 4 to 5 days or shortness of breath, so I'm going to go get this treatment. It doesn't work that way. You need to be one of our at-risk populations, and you need to have some pre-existing conditions, and you'll need a referral from your doctor to be able to receive the treatment. But what we're really worried about is that people will start to view this almost like they do STI treatment, like chlamydia or something. Hey, it's fine. I don't need to take the proper preventative strategies because I can just go get the antibiotics after all is said and done, and I'll be good to go in a few days. Not what we want to see happening, and also not the correct assumption. These treatments are effective, but just like anything else, they're not 100% effective. And so you're really rolling the dice with your health if you take that mindset. And if you're not a person with pre-existing conditions, you're not even going to be eligible to receive the treatment to begin with.
Well, speaking of antibiotics and things like that, are we seeing the state of Oregon with an influx of people using the animal drugs that they're talking about now? Or is that not really kind of our thing here?
Well, unfortunately, it is. We're not exempt from some of the poor logic that we see played out on the national stage. And yes, the anti-parasitic medication that has been touted as a potential treatment is in use in Oregon. People are coming by it. Unfortunately, you know, we have the prescription and the prescribing for animals is much different than humans. The dosage is different. However, you know, many people with horses and with other animals that have used some of these treatments have their hands on it and are distributing it. That's dangerous. The efficacy has not been proven. I just saw an NTBI journal posting where they looked across all the studies that are currently looking at all the available therapeutics, oral therapeutics, and we don't have any conclusive proof on the majority of them, including the most popular right now. I think it's absolutely important to understand that not only do we have we don't have efficacy on these, we don't have proof positive efficacy, but we also know that they can be dangerous and people can die. There's not correct dosage information. You know, when we're thinking about FDA approval, that's part of FDA approval that they look at. They really look not only at whether or not it will cure an illness, but what is the proper dosage. That's why we don't have Pfizer approval for under 12. It's not just about the safety. It's not just about the efficacy. It's saying, what is the proper dosage? We have to drill that down. There's lots of science that have to go into that. None of that has been done for some of these therapeutics. There's only a couple that have been approved, and they are primarily intravenous and need to be administered through the referral of a health provider and under the supervision of a health provider.
Well, and it seems like to me that the same person who won't get the shot that has been tested will do something like this. And I'm not saying all the ways are like that, but that just kind of seems like, well, I'm not going to go get a shot, but I'll take this animal drug here. And
yeah. And the danger is just, I mean, it's just astronomically higher of taking the anti-parasitic horse drug. I mean, think about it. You know, you have something that has literally never been used ever, even thought of being used until a few months ago. And has never been studied, whereas we have a vaccine that had, 40, 60,000 people as part of the initial trial. We have ongoing safety and efficacy studies and trials. We have third-party trials going on. I mean, and we also have, you know, millions of people all getting the vaccine and reporting out their conditions. And we know for a fact it's safe. There's the misinformation out there. You know, I was just talking to our incident commander and I was saying, hey, is there a way that we could come out with a public health advisory against misinformation saying that we believe just like racism is a public health threat, so is misinformation. Misinformation will cause death. It will cause disease. It will cause unnecessary hospitalization. And you know, while we're not taking that step just yet, it's absolutely true. less than research, less than thorough reports that people are posting and sending to their friends is dangerous. What I've seen recently that is really troubling is that people have gotten their hands on the marketing and communications document that was posted on the Pfizer vaccine before full FDA approval. And then since then, someone has grabbed that and then changed the dates, photoshopped the dates on it. And within the marketing communications on page 12, it says this is not an approved means to prevent COVID. By FDA has not received full approval. It's still under emergency use authorization. And that document, that fraudulent document that has been fraudulently altered, is being circulated. And unfortunately, for a little while after full FDA approval, just like everyone makes mistakes, the FDA didn't take down that document and replace it with the new document. Now they have. But it's made its way through all social media channels and everything else. And people have really locked onto that as if it's some sort of proof that the FDA approval is not legitimate. The FDA approval is 100% legitimate. And not only is it legitimate, but the casework and the science behind it is much more robust than many of the 17 vaccines that you get as a child for school age vaccinations. If you get a Tdap, there is absolutely no reason why you should not have confidence in the COVID vaccination. If you take birth control, your chances of getting a blood clot from an oral birth control pill is 1 in 5,000. 1 in 5,000. And the chances of getting a blood clot from the Johnson & Johnson vaccine is 1 in 999,000. Look at the difference there. And yet no one questions taking the birth control.
I totally get that. Hey, last question. I know you probably got to go. You're working hard there. One of the things that I think some people will want to know is, if you have a handle on this, of all the people that we're seeing here in the Florence area getting sick, do we know a percentage of how many of them are being transported for hospital, or are they a lot of non-hospitalized cases?
Yeah. So, you know, the majority of your cases there right now what we're looking at is probably about 60% of your cases will be down and out for at least a week. They will be at home. They will have shortness of breath. They're not going to be doing so well, but only about 5 to 10% of your cases are being transported to a medical facility. And so that is a relatively small number, but proportionally, you know, when you're looking at the risk factor, it's a pretty high risk. Much higher than many of your other sort of risks that you engage in on a daily basis. So I think that's really the way that we need to change our thinking about COVID is not necessarily always looking at our stats, but really looking at the overall risk and the long-term risk. The long-term risk of COVID is very severe. There's a high degree of variability from person to person. And now we're seeing many more cases in our younger populations with, a spike in individuals from ages 30 to 39 in the hospital, a spike in individuals from 50 to 59 dying. So it really is showing some troubling trends. And it does make you need to stop and think about the risk that you're engaging in if you choose not to mask, if you choose not to get vaccinated, if you choose to go about your daily activities and have gatherings and not keep adequate space from other people. You really are putting yourself at risk. You're putting you as an individual at risk. But, you know, from a public health standpoint, the bigger piece is that you're putting your entire community at risk. Florence needs you to stay healthy.
Absolutely.
Florence needs everybody to work at the restaurants, to work at the businesses, to keep your community alive. We need people well and able to work. We do not need them at home on their back, you know, and we do not need them in the hospital. There's a cost to that. I don't know how many people understand how hospitals work, but when you go and you pay that exorbitant hospital bill that you think is just astronomical and how could they charge so much, that's actually subsidized. You are not paying the full amount. Even if you don't have insurance, you're still not paying the full amount. So there is a community cost by virtue of those subsidies. On average in Lane County, when we look at the flu, which we have a vaccine for, which has a high degree of positive outcomes for most people. Most people get over the flu. They don't end up in the hospital. They don't die. And yet we spend $11 million every year as Lane County in lost worker productivity from the flu. So, and that's an unnecessary expense. We can prevent that just like we can COVID. So let's save ourselves money. Let's protect our communities. Let's invest in our future. Let's get the shot. And let's do what we have to do to get through this so we can get to a place where we can confidently say, hey, you can go about your barbecue and you don't have to feel bad about it. You can go about having a big get together at the beach and you can do so in confidence, you know, and it doesn't have to be a political statement. You know, it can just be normal activity. That's where we all want to be.
Right. And of course, you know, we're going to have ARC of Lane County, and you guys are going to have another vaccination clinic on September 11th, I believe, at the Sisal Middle School from 1 to 3 again. Hopefully we'll see a whole lot more people getting involved, because I do think we are seeing some vaccination rates going up around the area.
Yes, you are. And that's real positive. And I would just encourage anybody and everybody to come out to that clinic on September 11th. I think it's you know, that date has a lot of history behind it, obviously. You know, a lot of American lives were lost on that day. And, you know, at the risk of angering some people by likening it, you know, I can't think of a better time than to protect your community than that day. You know, to show a willingness to participate in an action that we know will save lives. We have lost way too many Americans. Let's prevent that. Go out to the vaccine clinic on September 11th. Get your shot. Do yourself a favor. Do your family a favor. Do your community a favor.
Jason Davis, Lane County Public Health, thank you so much for your time today.
No problem, sir. We'll talk to you soon.
Coming up next on Our Town, Gary Cargill is going to talk Rods and Roadies on the September edition of Our Town.